Sometimes when we put this show together, I encounter themes I didn't expect. Little bits of connective tissue that bind all of our stories. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And this week, I noticed that we have a lot of stories about adapting, whether it's adapting to something incredibly personal, like losing your house and figuring out how to recover from that, or adapting monetary policy to extraordinary conditions. Yes, we are going to explain negative interest rates in plain English. Plus, how fast food companies are adapting to a totally new universe of consumer preferences and cheap commodities. Come share your thoughts with us on our website, marketplace.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. This has been a particularly newsy week. We had a strong jobs report, 242,000 jobs created last month, and it feels like the election has kicked up a notch after Super Tuesday. So we are starting with the segment we call long and short. That's when we take those terms, which we've stolen from the world of finance, and use them for our purposes. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. We do it with news stories and current events. And this week, we have Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer from our D.C. Bureau and Jillian White, a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Lizzie.
Thanks.
All right, Jillian, I'm going to start with you. What are you long this week?
All right. So I am long the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And I am long on them because this week they filed not one but two lawsuits for workers who alleged that they were discriminated against because of sexual orientation. And this is kind of a big deal because the EEOC is the group that's responsible for making sure that people can't get fired for, you know, race, for their gender, for things like that. And up until now, they've said that sex kind of covers a pretty broad waterfront. So they think that it covers sexual identity, orientation, things like that. But it's felt recently like there's a bit of gray area, and that, as you can imagine, is pretty concerning for a lot of people. So them getting litigious on these two cases kind of puts some teeth behind it and says, hey, jobs, not only did we really mean this, but we will sue you if we find out that you are discriminating against people based on their sexual orientation and saying inappropriate things and being generally unprofessional. So I think that's a big move for them.
Yeah, and the history of the EEOC has been in the past that they tend not to bring a case unless they feel that it is very solid. Does that Right. give us a sense that they think they've really got something here?
Yeah, I think so. I think it gives us a sense that not only do they think that they really have something, but also I think that it says that they're really trying to send this message. It's not even just about these two cases. It's really about us sending a message to every employer out there that this is not okay. It doesn't matter if you think that this language is explicitly outlined. This is something we're not going to tolerate.
Nancy, what are you long this week?
I think there's going to be a brokered Republican convention.
Wow, you do?
Yeah, I'm going out on a limb here, Lizzie. But listen to this. There are, quote unquote, ghost delegates.
Oh, no. So what are those?
No. Not to scare you too much, but so when, say, Trump wins a state, he wins a certain number of delegates, right? You think, okay, that's fine. But some of those delegate positions haven't been filled. So he's just winning a slot. And those delegates still have to be elected by their parties. And that's going to happen this spring. So there is a possibility that on the first ballot at the convention, they could vote against Trump. Now, they're supposed to vote for whoever won the slot. That's what the rules say. But the Republican Party can also change the rules at the convention.
Perfect.
Jillian, I know your short is political, so let's stay in this vein. What do you have for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am so short on early polling. I think we've got to get rid of it. I think, or we at least have to stop talking about it. I feel like there's a consensus that polling in general is getting more difficult to rely on. The numbers are very squishy.
So then we've looked at that a bit in this show, yeah.
Yeah, so then when you start talking about early polling numbers in a cycle where there's so many things happening and every debate, every convention gets drawn out for days before and after, when we're, you know, gathering all this data so early and it's so unreliable, it just seems like there's not really a point and we can't rely on it. And it seems sometimes that it could even be damaging because, you know, you go to bed thinking one thing and you wake up thinking something completely different. And at a time where people really don't understand or trust what's happening in the political system, it seems like maybe we should just wait for things to firm up, you know, just for a few hours.
I'm with you. I'm with you, Jillian. And, you know, the interesting thing is in the Virginia Republican primary on Tuesday of this past week, Democrats could vote in the Republican primary. In Virginia, voters can vote in whichever primary they want. And I know one person who's a Democrat who voted in the Republican primary for Trump.
Wow.
So okay. There are so many layers to the campaign this year.
And one of the things we've seen is that polling companies are trying to figure out how to adapt to this new landscape where people don't have as many landlines and they don't want to call on their cell phone and all of those different things. We're sort of in this age of proliferating data and yet a real overhaul in terms of how we as a society use it and how companies use it to kind of affect elections. And I don't think anyone has the real answer to that yet.
Yeah, totally.
All right, Nancy, give us a short.
Okay. I do not think the Fed will institute negative interest rates this year. I'm qualifying it this year. Janet Yellen, the Fed chair, was on the Capitol Hill last month, and she was asked, you know, about negative interest rates. And I should explain that negative interest rates are where a bank basically pays their central bank to store its money. They don't get an
interest
rate.
And this is what's happening in Japan right now.
It's happening in Japan. It's happening in Europe. I went to a conference in New York and talked to one of the Fed governors who was there. And I said, hey, how about those negative interest rates? You guys going to do that this year? And she said, well, no, we're just kind of watching to see what happens in those other countries.
Yeah, we're going to have more actually on negative interest rates and getting into a lot of the mechanics of this with Patty Hirsch a little bit later in the show. Jillian White from The Atlantic, Nancy Marshall-Genzer from Marketplace. Thank you guys very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much.
When we talk about the economy meeting real life, well, this next story is a perfect example. So in your real life, maybe you bought fast food recently and maybe you noticed it was cheap, really cheap. And the reasons for that are both macroeconomic and because companies are adapting to big changes in the restaurant business. To explain what's going on, we have Vanessa Wong, deputy business editor at BuzzFeed, and she writes about food a lot. Hi, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
It's nice to see you.
It's good to see you.
I want to start by opening up my wallet. Okay.
Ooh.
Secrets.
So here's a dollar. I carry around a lot of change. $2. Let's go with $2.50.
Nice.
In this world of psychotically cheap fast food, what can I get for $2.50?
You can get so much food for $2.50 right now in fast food. Fast food's ridiculously cheap at the moment. So there are deals at McDonald's, there are deals at Burger King, there are deals at Wendy's, and they all kind of revolve around this kind of like $4 to $5 price point. So at McDonald's, you could get like two giant sandwiches. Like you could get two Big Macs for $5.
Wow.
And at Burger King, they have kind of like this meal deal where you can get five things for $4.
Well, what is driving all of this? Why is it so cheap right now?
Well, there are a few things that are happening. One, commodities are really cheap now. So chicken's down a lot. The price of beef has been falling for a few months now. Dairy's really low. It's been slowly dropping for a couple of years at this point.
Is this because of oil? Because so many producers rely on oil kind of in their production chain, or is it separated from that?
That's part of it. There were a few things that were pushing up the prices of commodities a couple of years ago. You had things like, you know, dairy shortage due to exports. You had, you know, various diseases that might have been affecting flocks or, you know, herds of other animals. And right now things seem pretty good. But the other thing with oil is that it's also giving consumers a little bit more disposable cash.
Hmm.
And that's the other side of it. So gas is like so cheap right now. Gas is like $2 a gallon, more or less, in New York City. And this impacts all consumers, but particularly low-income consumers who are a primary target demographic for fast food chains. So they're all hoping that by offering these deals, they can boost traffic to their restaurants.
How much of a market share have they lost to fast casual chains? I mean, we keep sort of hearing that phrase, and E. coli aside, places like Chipotle have been doing really well.
Right. Indeed, E. coli aside.
Yes.
Right. They have lost a lot of market share in the past few years. It's kind of been one of the biggest trends in fast food. There's just a limited number of customers at this point, and fast food restaurants all have to compete for them. And with, you know, some market share lost to these fast casual chains, they have like a smaller pool of customers even now to reach for. And so that's really, I think, more than fast food competing against fast casual, it's more like traditional fast food all competing with each other for a shrinking consumer pool.
Which brings up this kind of overarching question of, at what point does lowering your prices so much hurt you if you're McDonald's, Burger King, Taco Bell, whatever?
Well, believe it or not, I don't think any of them would do any of these deals if it was a money loser.
So true.
Even if it's the slimmest profit margin, I think they still see it as worthwhile because they can still bring more customers into their stores, hopefully not lose them out to a competitor who has a better deal. And right now, that's kind of the name of the game.
Do you foresee these prices going up anytime soon?
I do wonder. There are a number of initiatives in the pipeline, say at McDonald's, who are committed at the moment to boosting food quality as well. So you've seen like a wave of announcements in the past few months, cage-free eggs, switching to antibiotic-free meat, et cetera, et cetera. And none of these things come for free, right? Especially at the beginning when the industry is making a shift, I think the cost increase is going to be greater until like everyone jumps on board. So ultimately, I think that cost gets passed down to the consumer and everyone's saying, well, we're doing it because of shifting consumer demand. But we'll see whether or not these changes are really worth it to the customer in the end.
Vanessa Wong from BuzzFeed, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
With the exception of very few people, most of us have had financial setbacks that we've had to adapt to. In our Facebook discussion this week, I shared my own story of getting sick, losing my job, and trying to figure out how to recover and get back in the workforce. Those recoveries can say a lot about who we are, what we value, and where the economy is at any given moment. This week, we asked about your economic recoveries. Sheila Brennan got in touch. She's 56 and lives in Vallejo, California. Her trouble coincided with the recession.
You know, I had been working in Silicon Valley companies in software development as a technical writer for about 15 years. And, you know, I was having a medical problem and I was also really stressed out. And I just decided to quit my job. And, of course, it was at the worst possible moment.
So when was this roughly?
This was 2008.
Ooh.
Yeah. Oops. Yeah.
And you reached out to us because our question was framed as a sort of a question of personal economic recovery. What was that process like?
Well, you know, at first I was so burned out, I didn't even want to go back to, you know, high tech. And I was thinking, what else can I do? And then when I started looking for high tech jobs, there weren't any. And I had worked when I was in college in clerical jobs in hospitals, which always pay better than other clerical jobs, and finally jammed my foot in the door as an on-call clerk. And, I told the lady in my interview that I was going to make myself so useful she couldn't live without me. She just thought I was funny. And when I got there, I started just going about deciding I was going to make everything work. And I'm really good at problem solving, and I just started fixing problems and teaching people ways to do things better. And because I was on call, I had to learn all the jobs in my department. So I learned all the jobs and just, you know, made myself really useful. So then I got full time. And then when the person that did tech support for all the agencies in my area was doing a really bad job, and that person got fired, but I applied for it, and they encouraged me to apply for it, and I got it, and it's like the perfect tailor-made job for me.
Were there moments after you'd quit your job where you thought, oh, my God, how do I make the money work?
Oh, my God, yes. I had my daughter was in a really expensive private college, and I thought I would only be off work a few months, and it wasn't, but managed to get her through there because I didn't want her to take out any student loans or anything. And I did lose my house. I paid their tuitions, but I did lose my house. So I had
Really?
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, you know, I had a Bay Area mortgage, and I thought, you know, I was safe because I didn't buy an expensive house. You know, I'm pretty frugal, but it was more important to me to pay their tuition than to pay my mortgage. And so I just let the house go. I was making, you know, less than half than I had been making before. I mean, it was depressing, but it's also, you know, I grew up moving a lot. And so to me, to like change jobs and move is not that traumatic. My dad is a geologist, and the oil company would call and say, you're moving to Tulsa tomorrow, you know, and we'd get up and go. So, I mean, it was, I don't think it was super traumatic to me as it would be to some people. Okay. And one thing I do want to emphasize is how much of it is luck. I just can't stand when people talk about, I mean, I work hard, but so does everybody who's a subsistence farmer, you know, and it's a lot of it is just luck.
Well, Sheila Brennan, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Bye.
Thank you to everyone who left us a voicemail, wrote us on Facebook about your recoveries. Next week, yes, we just got a strong jobs report. The unemployment rate is at 4.9%. But Americans clearly still feel anxious about the economy. So what's at the top of your list of worries? And is it in your personal financial life or something in the bigger economy? Let us know by going to Marketplace.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us at 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be used on the air. Here's a question for you. Would you ever deposit money in the bank if you wouldn't get any interest? Or even if the bank would actually give you less money back? Yes, we talked a little about negative interest rates earlier in the show, but we wanted to dig into whether the Federal Reserve might actually do this. And since it's kind of complicated, we brought in our resident explainer, Patty Hirsch, who hosts our whiteboard series. Thank you for coming on, Patty.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Earlier in the show, we talked about this idea that the Fed might install negative interest rates. What does that actually mean?
Well, which part? I think the might is an important thing.
Yeah. I think, well, you know, all of it. Let's take it apart piece by piece.
Well, firstly, let's just say that, you know, Janet Yellen is raising a flag here and saying, hey, it's possible we might do this at some point in the future. She is not saying we are going to go to negative interest rates tomorrow. There's no way she's saying that right now. So let's just, if anybody's freaking out about negative interest rates in the U.S. right now, calm down. That's not going to happen straight away. But the whole concept of having negative interest rates means that the central bank, the Federal Reserve, will start to charge some banks a certain amount of interest on some of the reserves that they keep at the Fed. So we're actually talking about a fairly small amount of money. Wouldn't be that significant, even if it did actually happen.
We're sort of talking about a lender paying a borrower, yes?
Yeah. So usually if you borrow money, right, you pay for the privilege of doing it. Right. So if you lend money, like, for example, when you put money in a bank, you're putting money in deposit at the bank, you're lending the bank money. And as a result, the bank pays you a certain amount of interest, even if it's only really small. Whereas in this case, what's happening is you're putting your money in deposit at the bank, or these banks will put in money in reserve at the central bank, and they have to pay for the privilege of doing that, which is most unusual.
What does it mean, I guess, for just your everyday person?
It means very little for your everyday person, right? This is a cost. It's not like the banks are going to start turning around and charging you and me for keeping our money in our savings accounts at our banks. They're not going to do that. They're still going to pay a rate of interest to people who put their money on deposit. Essentially, this is a cost that the banks themselves are going to have to eat. And they will eat that quite willingly, because if they do pass on those costs to consumers, it's going to really irritate people. It's going to drive them crazy. They're going to pull their money out of the banks. And remember, once again, the fact is that these banks, when they leave their money on deposit at the central banks, and actually get charged for these in the places that this is actually happening, where you're seeing negative interest rates in places like Japan and Europe, it's only on a very small amount of the deposits that they have in those banks. In actual fact, only about 2.5% of total bank assets are subjected to the penalty fee at the moment in Japan and Europe.
But the economic theory behind this is if you're a bank, you say, gee, well, I guess I'd rather lend my money out and maybe spur economic activity than keep it on deposit somewhere where I might have to pay the central bank, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's something that we should clarify here. A lot of people think, oh, well, if the banks are going to get charged money to hold money in reserves, it means they're going to lend that money out into the community. That's not what this is designed to do. What this is designed to do is to lower short-term interest rates on other types of debt. So the important thing that this is supposed to do is to bring down the interest rates on debt that for overnight money or for short-term loans to consumers, or maybe even, you know, sort of the 10-year rate on bonds, the kind of thing that a lot of loans are actually based upon. So a lot of loans in our system are based on that 10-year treasury note, right? So if the rate on that treasury note goes down, it means that the rates on car loans, maybe even home loans, is going to drop. And that's what it's designed to do, is to bring those rates down, particularly the short-term rates.
Japan is sort of entering this territory. Let's talk about their 10-year bond and whether we've seen this work.
Yeah, so this is really interesting what Japan has done. So its 10-year bond is now there's a negative interest rate there. So what people are doing, usually what happens whenever a government issues a bond to the public, right, it comes with an interest rate. So the public is being essentially compensated for lending to the government. In this situation, the 10-year bond comes with a negative rate. So if you're lending to the government, you're actually paying for the privilege to lend to the government, which sounds completely insane.
Which sounds bananas.
It sounds completely nuts. I mean, who on earth is going to be wanting to lend money to the government and actually having to pay for the privilege? I mean, it sounds crazy. But there is kind of a small method to the madness here. Firstly, what this has done is it's brought those short-term interest rates that I'm talking about really, really low. It means that the 10-year rate is now negative, which should bring the rate on consumer loans down significantly as a result of that. So that's one thing that it's doing, which is a great thing for consumers and a great thing for the economy. For the people, however, who are lending to the government, you're like, well, why would they actually do that? Well, there are a number of reasons for that. Some of them are more complicated to do with hedges and that kind of thing. But some of them have to do with the fact that, you know, people want to keep their money in Japan, especially Japanese institutions. They want to be loyal and lend to the government. They want to help people out. They want to make sure that, you know, their money is easily accessed, because the alternative to lending to the government for a 10-year note is to buy, say, a U.S. Treasury 10-year note, which is going to be really, really difficult for them to do, because then they have to, well, more complicated for them to do, because then they have to deal with currency fluctuations. They've got to change into US dollars, all this kind of stuff. It's much more convenient for them to have the 10-year bond in Japan.
Do we know if it's helping the Japanese economy yet?
Not yet. I mean, a lot of people look at the Japanese economy and say, well, actually, it's not in that bad a state as it is right now. And Abenomics, as they call them, seem to be working out reasonably well right now. So it's not like Japan is, you know, circling the drain or anything like that. But there's no doubt that, you know, Japan has been doing slightly better. It needs to have more impetus. This is one way of trying to keep the sort of positive momentum of the recovery in that economy going.
Patty Hirsch, the host of Marketplace's Whiteboard Explainer series. Thank you very much.
That's my pleasure, Lizzie. Thank you.
Now we have a story about how we adapt natural resources for human use. The Nile River has been hugely important to communities along its banks since basically the earliest civilizations. And today, countries in the Nile River Basin are wrangling over who should control it and how its water should be used. In Uganda, the government wants to use the White Nile, a tributary of the main river, for hydroelectric dams. That's sparking a debate between different sectors of the country's economy on the best way to use the river. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams traveled to Uganda and has this report.
You can hear the churning rapids of the White Nile long before you see them, a dull roar that hits you as soon as you exit the car at a scenic overlook. This spot is in a rural area near the central Ugandan city of Jinja. From the overlook, you can see a wide expanse of the frothing river. The lush vegetation of the forest comes right up to the edge, but could soon be underwater. Much more placid water.
The Nsimba Power Dam under construction is expected to deliver the intended 183 megawatts.
That's local media reporting about the hydroelectric dam under construction 25 miles away at Nsimba. If completed, according to the current plan, it would create a huge man-made lake, big enough to submerge the rapids of Kalagala Falls and much of the forest around it. And those rapids aren't just pretty to look at, they're financially valuable as well. These rapids are considered some of the best in the world. They draw professional kayakers who train in the warm waters year-round.
Because once they build that dam, definitely I'll lose the job because all these rapids will get flooded.
Alex Mzungu is a tour guide for the local whitewater rafting company, Nile River Explorers. Tourists come as well, clinging to yellow rafts as guides steer them along the surging river that races through the tropical forest.
Yeah, I've been playing on the water. I had my American team going rafting, enjoying the day.
Mzungu pulls his kayak from the churning rapids, drenched head to toe. He's been a guide for almost 15 years. Mzungu remembers the impact of a different dam, the Bujagali Dam, built upstream in 2012. It shortened the length of the route available for rafting and kayaking, harming local tourism businesses.
Since they built that dam, Bujagali Dam, most of the things changed. All the rapids changed. And we end up losing a lot of people who used to come.
To secure funding for that dam, Uganda made a promise. It told the World Bank it would protect the rapids Mzungu and others currently rely on from future development. Josh Clem is policy director at the environmental advocacy group International Rivers.
The government quite clearly signed this agreement that it would not violate the Kalagala Falls, which are an important area in their own right for their kind of spiritual value and the tourism industry there.
The World Bank says the Asimba Dam, at least as currently planned, could violate that agreement. It's already under construction. Clem says there are other options. They could scale back the size.
Depending on the height of the dam, the reservoir that would be filled behind it could submerge the Kalagala Falls, or it could be built to a height that would be lower and generate less power, but it could still ensure that the Kalagala agreement that it signed on to wouldn't be violated.
The government says it's aware of the economic consequences of these kinds of projects. Ugandan Energy Ministry spokesman Bukenya Mutovo.
First of all, we have to accept the fact that we have an energy balance problem. Uganda doesn't have enough energy to drive its economic development programs.
According to the World Bank, only 18% of Ugandans have access to electricity. But as Mutovo points out, the country does have a lot of water resources.
Hydropower is, first of all, clean energy, green energy. We try as much as possible to minimize or even manage those impacts because there is nothing that you are going to do that does not have an impact on anything, including human beings and animals and fish and stuff like that.
Mutovo agrees eco and adventure tourism are important for the economy, but he says not important enough to offset the energy gains from dam projects.
We have to choose between two. Which one do we take? Do we sacrifice energy for tourism? Do we run both? Or do we sacrifice tourism for energy?
That increased energy powers other industries in the region besides tourism. Like the sprawling industrial complex of steel rolling mills. The foundry previously had to schedule its operation around regular power outages. That's according to plant electrical manager Columbi Charles.
We could be told, steel rolling mills, please, on such a day, from this time to this time, you would have no power. And it used to be. You couldn't help it.
He says with the extra power from the Bujagali Dam, the company was able to double its staff. It went from 8 to 24 hours of operation per day, adding new shifts. That extra productivity helped fund a new facility. Now the company recycles locally collected scrap metal, so it doesn't have to import raw materials. But even Charles says there needs to be a balance between protecting the falls and making power.
We have foregone our falls, several of them, in the name of generating power. Now the question is, for how long should this continue?
Charles feels confident the Ugandan government will be able to figure it out. The tourism industry is lobbying hard, trying to make sure the government does. I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Kimberly's trip to Uganda was made possible through the International Women's Media Foundation's Great Lakes Reporting Fellowship. Usually when we talk about TV on this show, we are talking about things you can watch streaming on Netflix or Amazon or Hulu, but not this week. A new network is launching on actual cable television aimed at millennials. The news outlet Vice is up with its own network channel, Viceland. And here to tell us more is our entertainment correspondent, Adrian Hill. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, Lizzie.
Give us the big picture of what Vice is up to.
All right. So Viceland, which is the new channel from Vice, is replacing A&E's network H2. And if you've never heard of it, neither had I. It was a spinoff of the History Channel, underperforming spinoff. So Viceland is trying to cater to the millennial crowd with this network and attract some people who already consume Vice's content online. Most of Vice, as you know, is sort of digital. It's also got a presence on HBO. They're launching with shows that center on sort of edgy, jumpy, first-person investigative journalism-style documentaries. They've got Spike Jonze as their creative director. They've got hosts that are well-known like Ellen Page. I spoke with TV critic Brian Lowry, and he gave me a pretty succinct description of this network.
Each show comes with sort of a cutesy title that's designed to make copy editors crazy. Things like Weedekit and Gaycation. And then each of them basically takes sort of a subset of, you know, American life or the human experience and then comes at it in a very sort of narrow way, which I felt as if you handed a channel over to a group of anthropology professors and said, here, you've got your own linear cable channel. This is sort of what it would end up looking like.
I mean, appealing, unappealing, you tell me, Lizzie.
Well, it's interesting from a branding standpoint, right? You have, I would suppose, built-in audiences in certain ways. I want to ask you about some of these shows. But first, Vice has a reputation for being a little, for lack of a better word, bro-y, appealing
Fair
to
enough.
Young dudes. Do these shows do that? I mean, it doesn't sound like Gaycation, if you've got Ellen Page hosting it, does that. But what do we have?
Some of what you're going to see on Vice is the reason people like Vice, and you're going to see some of that bro-y stuff. But I think they're trying to offer more to other people as well. So you have Gaycation with Ellen Page, which looks actually like a pretty interesting show. You have Weedekit, which focuses on the culture of marijuana. There's a show called Noisy, which is a travel show that looks at music scenes around the world. But there's no radical rethink here. I mean, this is, again, that like edgy Vice as you know it.
The radical rethink question, I suppose, follows on, wait a minute, if you're already this well-known digital brand, what are you doing going on mainstream television?
Right. I mean, it does seem a little bit like going backwards. And I talked to an analyst about this, and he had a couple of thoughts. One is that even though we hear all about millennials abandoning television, abandoning cable as we know it, there's still a majority of millennial households have a cable subscription. The second is that ad dollars are still huge on linear television. So if they can make this work and attract the audience, there's a huge potential advertising payout. And three, he said, because Vice is partnering with A&E, the stakes just aren't that high. They didn't go out and spend millions to buy a channel. They're not building a subscriber base from zero. The subscribers are already there because they had H2. You know, it's not risk-free, but there's not a ton of risk. And finally, if it doesn't work out, he said, Vice can just put this stuff on its digital platforms where people already are.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is in it then for A&E, their partner?
Well, again, low stakes, right? I mean, H2 wasn't doing much. So there's an opportunity here to take Vice and really breathe some life and some hipness and some youth into cable.
Are there shows you're particularly looking forward to?
So, Lizzie, I'm a cord cutter myself. I do not get Viceland.
Entertainment correspondent.
I watch so much television. I just don't watch it in the traditional way.
Okay.
There's nothing I'm going to go out of my way to watch immediately. But, you know, there's another hurdle for Viceland here, and that is that even for people like me who like documentary-style programming and like investigative journalism, there's so many outlets right now for that and for that done well. I mean, HBO, CNN is getting into docs, Showtime, Netflix. So Viceland has stiff competition even in this sort of genre that I think lots of people are attracted to right now.
Adrian Hill, our entertainment correspondent, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
Okay, let's talk about ad blockers. This used to be, you know, a tool that you could use if you were a like cool tech person and you were very in the know, but they're everywhere now.
Yeah, they are, Lizzie. Do you use any?
I don't, because I'm kind of a tech moron, which is why we do this segment with you.
Well, that's fair enough. The kind of interesting thing here is how we define ad blockers. So offline reading tools, I use one called Pocket. They effectively block ads because they are essentially taking what you're reading offline, which means it's hard for companies to deliver ads to you. So you could call them an ad blocker in a way. Ad blockers will take advertising out of a website you're reading. We know about this. They'll also pull the ad off at the beginning of a YouTube video that you might see.
Oh.
So a lot of people use them on YouTube. The reason we're even talking about this is because of the evolution of our online behavior. We expect content to be free these days, right? And the reason that's mostly possible is because of this kind of powerful dual piston internet engine that is part data, part advertising. But users are getting more engaged in the conversation around privacy when it comes to their data. Also, they're getting tired of advertising shot at their eyeballs all the time. And this is why, on the one hand, you see more so-called native advertising or advertising that looks like regular non-ad content, but also these ad blockers we're talking about.
Walk me through how ad blockers actually work.
Yeah, so to understand it, you have to understand a little bit about how you're tracked online.
Okay.
So websites and advertisers are tracking you constantly as you move around the web. Search and browsing history helps companies target your favorite specific ads they think you'll actually act on. One of the major ways sites are tracking you is through something called canvas fingerprinting. When you enter a website that uses canvas fingerprinting, the browser is instructed to capture a kind of invisible image of your device. So it sort of recognizes your device. And what it's really doing is assigning a kind of specific signifier to where you're coming from, your device, your computer, something like that, and watching your device move around the site. The site Digital Trends reports that this practice is so common nowadays that even sites like whitehouse.gov actually use it. So it's happening a lot.
So what are my ad blocking options? I mean, I sometimes browse with the Chrome incognito mode, but again, I'm sort of a neophyte here.
Well, unfortunately, that incognito or private browser mode doesn't actually protect you from advertising necessarily.
Okay, cool.
It really just protects your history and treats you like a kind of unknown user as you move around the web. But there are lots of options for ad blockers. You really only need to search the App Store on your device to find them, or you can search just through your regular browser to find them, except for when you can't. So you might remember last year, the famous developer Marco Arment, he, you know, helped to create Tumblr, is kind of a famous Apple developer. He made an ad blocker called Peace, which quickly became super popular, went to the top of the App Store, but then he took it down.
Right. I mean, the question here is, okay, if businesses depend on ads for their business, are you actually hurting a place that you want to support? I love community journalism. I want to support small newspapers and, you know.
Yeah. And that was, that's what Marco basically, that's what he said. At the end of the day, ad blockers are, if you're being real, breaking the business proposition of surfing the web for free.
Which might be the heart of this, that question of whether that's a real business proposition. So I guess where does that leave us?
One of the things I like to think about on marketplace tech is this conundrum of how everything has been made easy for the user. Yet at the same time, it's really important to educate yourself further as a user.
Yeah.
A good step to take is to understand better how you are being tracked online. And one interesting service that does a bit of both ad blocking and giving you information on how you're being tracked is called Ghostery. So Ghostery interacts a little bit with the coding of the website that you're on at any given time. And I talked with Ghostery CEO Scott Meyer about some of the specifics of that.
We can unpack any web page and pretty much any app on the fly and enable consumers to see what's happening and control how all of these companies get access to their browsing habits.
So it's essentially a dashboard, Lizzie, that kind of tracks the ads in real time and tells you what companies are tracking you, how they're tracking you, and gives you this kind of information. And from there, you have the ability to choose to block ads if you want to.
So it's the proposition that knowledge is power. And if you have that knowledge, you're an empowered consumer.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
I've told you before about the Brexit, that is the possibility that the UK might leave the European Union. It'll be up for a public vote in June. And recent polls show that the economy and immigration are the big issues on British voters' minds. Ben Judah is a writer and journalist who grew up in London and recently spent time living with migrants there to learn more about who they are and why they come to the city. Here's the report he put together for the BBC.
People see this place to be like heaven. They think like as soon as you arrived, you know, you start plucking money off trees and picking them from the floor or wherever, but it's entirely different.
This is the New London, an immigrant megacity where nearly 40% were born abroad. Wester is a trash picker from Ghana. He lives in a cramped house with 11 others, all migrants.
How long is the commute?
Just me about an hour.
Who are the people on the train in the morning?
Well, you see a lot of people going to work, mostly immigrants, you know, going to work at this time of the day.
London is changing. Around half the street sleepers are now Eastern European.
Nikolai is Romanian. Back home, he was in the army. But here he sleeps in a makeshift hovel, planks of wood tossed together, behind a supermarket. He forages what they throw away.
Is London difficult?
It's difficult, yeah. I don't know English, I come in here, it's very difficult.
Every day, Nikolai touts for work. There's no minimum wage and no insurance for thousands like him. On the Romanian black market, the lowest wage I ever saw was one chicken and chips for a day's work.
Why do they come? Because for men of a trade, for the few, the London dream can be real.
Marius is a building boss from Poland. He's a winner. Work for his skilled team never slows down.
I had literally £250 in my pocket and I stayed in a room with a friend of mine, which he was already here. And I went out literally the next day, coming into London. I went out to look for the job. I would stand on the corner where you've got all other chaps waiting for the work, and I was picked up by the other people, and that's how it worked those days.
Every town in Poland has its London son, the boy who made it. He inspires 100 more.
When all the Poles were coming, people were a little bit cautious about us. Now they're much more open. They prefer us to do the building sites. And they prefer us to do the building for them, comparing to the native people, if I put it this way.
So if I came from your hometown and I asked you, should I come to London, what would you say?
I would say yes. Come over. I own 3 companies at the moment. I've got some rental properties. I own the house. I'm very happy, you know.
Do you think your children will be English first or Polish first?
Looks like they're going to be English first, because we speak Polish at home, but they do speak English to each other. They speak perfectly Polish, perfectly English. but still, I would say they're going to be more English than Polish.
But mostly, migrants clean, wait, and guard the Golden City, never to enter. Jessie is from the Philippines. She works as a maid for the absentee owners of a superflat.
I have missed my family very much. I left my daughter when she was 1 year and 11 months old. Because back home, I couldn't earn money to support my family. So I have to make an arrangement with my husband that one of us has to go and one has to stay to take care of my daughter.
At night, London murmurs, a city of African night cleaners, Filipino prayers, and Romanian beggars. To be poor in London is to be tired. For years, Wester, like so many others, worked two jobs, cleaning day and night.
I had a dream of becoming a system engineer, Microsoft system engineer. But for now, I think I've kind of gone astray. I'm still not giving up on my dreams. You know, I'm still working on it. I mean, I can't complain. I'm doing well in the cleaning business, so I can't complain. I'm not hungry.
When you told your friends in Ghana you were going to London, what did they say?
Well, everybody was happy. Like I said, some people back home think Europe, once you step foot there, you become, you know, a rich man overnight. And even to date, you still have some people calling you and asking you for money. And then even if you tell them you are broke, they tell you, nah, you are not. Because when we see your pictures on Facebook, when we see you here, you know, we know you guys are languishing in, you know, I mean, in riches and all that. You're just being a miser. You're just being stingy because you don't want to send us no money, you know. And this is what I want them to know, that life is not all that, you know, milk and roses here in London.
Did you find work today?
I don't find. Maybe tomorrow. Maybe tomorrow is another day. You know, every day it's another day. The chance it gives, the London gives 1 million chance every day. You know.
After dark, Nikolai hides behind the wooden planks of his hovel. London glows in the villages of Africa, Eastern Europe, and Asia, stirring up dreams.
That story came to us from our partners at the BBC. And that's our show for this week. Next week, what tops your list of economic worries? Is it something in your personal financial life or a bigger picture thing? Come tell us. Visit Marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Haley Hirschman, with help this week from Golda Arthur. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.